The moments, the memories. This is the Heroes of the 500 on 93 WIBC.
Here he goes, the final lap. Three wide. Who will make the pass? Miss.
Spectacular crash, almost at the head of the main stretch. There's so much fire and so much smoke, I am unable to see any car at all.
It was one of the defining moments in the history of the Indianapolis 500.
It is with deepest regret that we make this announcement.
I've come here, I've had the dream, I met all the people, and now it could be over.
Eddie Sachs exits this earth in a race car. Knowing Eddie, I assume that's the way he would have wanted it.
The 1964 Indianapolis 500 was a day of triumph and tragedy, an unusual combination of firsts and lasts that is still etched in the memory of those who attended the tragic and historic race, and for those who listened around the world. For the next 2 hours, join us as we look back at one of the darkest days in the history of the Indianapolis 500 with those who were there.
When Eddie hit those two cars burning gasoline, it was like jerking the door open on a blast furnace. It was hot.
This is Heroes of the 500, 1964. I'm John Herrick. The month of May opened with two very distinct camps forming in Gasoline Alley and in the grandstands surrounding the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. On one side, you had those who backed the race-proven front-engine roadsters, which had been the dominant car for more than a decade. On the other side, the backers of the new so-called funny cars, light rear-engine machines favored by organizations such as Team Lotus. Their rear-engine, Lotus 25, made a spectacular debut with the great Jim Clark driving to a second-place finish the previous year. And they had a growing number of supporters. Author Bob Gates says loyalties were divided at 16th and Georgetown.
That's what created the huge fans that practices and qualifying started happening in that era, beginning in 1963, because it became the American drivers against the foreign drivers. And that whole stretch of time from 63 through, 66, 67, it was the Americans against the foreigners. It was the rear engine cars against the front engine cars. It was the, it became Goodyear against Firestone, but it was the Offey engine, the traditional Offey engine against the Ford Motor Company.
A.J. Foyt and Parnelli Jones both had rear engine cars available to drive, and both practiced in the new machines. But both of the drivers who had previously won the 500 chose to stick with what they called their dinosaurs, their tried and true front engine roadsters. The day before the run for the pole, a man who would become a Speedway institution first set foot on the grounds at 16th and Georgetown. Donald Davidson, who had spent 5 years learning about the Indianapolis 500 in England, came to the track as a visitor for the first time on May 15, 1964, after making the long trip from the United Kingdom. Davidson said the Brickyard definitely lived up to his expectations on arrival.
Oh, way beyond. Way beyond, because I'd seen the films and read the books and, all the Floyd Clymer books and everything. So just everything, it was surreal to be here. But the thing, and I can't stress this enough, I was absolutely astonished at how friendly the people were. And this, it sounds like, the Chamber of Commerce talking here, but I was astonished. I never expected the drivers to be, and the car owners to be such open, and the chief mechanics. And a few of them were a little reserved, but I thought they would all be. And to immediately be taken into the inner circle and first name basis and within, minutes of arriving, within an hour or so of arriving, I was being invited into garages. And the day after I got there was the first qualifying day. And it just seemed like I met everybody.
Davidson had plenty of respect for the veterans of the 500, much to the surprise of many who met him early on.
I don't know how many people said to me, oh, you from England, and so you've come over to see Jimmy Clark. No, I came over to see Foyt and Parnelli Jones and Roger Ward and Jim Rathman, who wasn't running anymore. Troy Ruttman, those are who I came to see.
While Parnelli Jones was the defending champion of the 500, it was Clark, the defending world driving champion, who many fans came to see as well. Both Jones and A.J. Foyt were highly complimentary of the Scottish star when we asked them about the late legend.
But I thought he was much a natural race driver, and he was certainly a gentleman. You know, he was really a nice person, you know, and I enjoyed my short relationship with him. But he was a very talented race driver, no question about it.
To me, in my time, he's probably was one of the greatest Formula One drivers. I mean, they've had some great drivers over Schumacher and all them, and but I think Jimmy could run with any of them. What I had a lot of respect for him, that I was with the factory team, the Ford. Then I watched him get in a factory car, but it wasn't the quality I had, and run a hell of a race, and with no power steering and all that like they have today down south. So take my hat off to him, because I seen him win, you know, at Milwaukee. And, I mean, he's just a great race driver, regardless of what you put him in. I would have to say he was probably, in my books, probably the best Formula One driver in my time.
This is Heroes of the 500, 1964.
The unsettled question until 4 hours from now will be, have the rear engine Ford V8s made obsolete iron out of the Meyer Drake Offenhausers, which haven't been changed in some 35 years? And also, is the rear engine car superior to the conventional roadster with the engine in the front?
This is Heroes of the 500, 1964. I'm John Herrick. Qualifying for the 1964 Indianapolis 500 was a true changing of the guard. Two-time Indy 500 winner Roger Ward was the first to break the track record, setting new 1 and 4 lap records. But Ward's stay at the top was short-lived. Former co-rookie of the year, Bobby Marshman, knocked Ward off the top spot in the Pure Oil Firebird Special, averaging nearly 158 miles an hour. Marshman looked like he would be the pole sitter until Scotland's Jim Clark blistered the brickyard, setting a new one-lap track record of 159.337 miles per hour and a new four-lap mark of 158.828. Clark, the defending world driving champion, became the first foreign-born driver to win the pole since 1919. The voice of the 500, Sid Collins, spoke to both Clark and Ward before the race.
Two of the men on the fastest front row in Speedway history. The pole sitter, Jimmy Clark, this his second race, and Roger Ward on the outside of the front row in this his 14th 500. Jimmy, how do you plan to drive when the green flag comes down?
Well, obviously I'd like to go to the front if I could and stay there the 200 laps, but I know it's not going to be easy.
Have you ever led a race from the start to finish?
Several times in Europe, yes.
Not this type of race, though?
Well, I led Milwaukee from start to finish last year, the 200.
Were you in that one, Rog?
Yes, I'm afraid I was, and he led her from start to finish.
How do you like being on the outside in the groove, so to speak?
Well, it's a wonderful place to start the race. I wish I had the same transmission he did. If I did, maybe I could tie him to the corner. But I think as the race progresses, we'll be running as competitively as possible.
How about these cars right behind you? Are you worried about Parnelli Jones and A.J. Foyt in that second row, Jimmy?
Oh, yes. I think, hoping anyway, that it won't get the jump on us, but I think I've got enough to contend with the front row.
Have you been told how fast to keep a pace and start the race when the flag comes down?
Well, we've been told how fast they're going to run on the pace lap, but they haven't said how fast we can come across the start-finish line yet.
So that's up to you, then, to guide the course.
So they say.
Roger, does that appeal to you?
Well, that's the way it is. He won the right to set the pace by sitting on the pole, and all the rest of us can do is hope we can keep up.
And be careful of Bobby Marshman in between you, will you?
We certainly will.
Good luck to you, Roger, the veteran. This is your 14th 500, and Jimmy Clark in your second.
As Sid Collins mentioned, Jones qualified his car fourth on the grid. Jones's roadster Calhoun was the same car he had driven to victory over Clark the previous year. Foyt put his Sheridan Thompson Special in the center of row two on pole day. Foyt, Ward, and Jones were three of the four former winners in the field, joined by Troy Ruttman, and seven rookies qualified for the 1964 Indianapolis 500 as well. One of those rookies was a driver with a background very different from most of his fellow freshman drivers. Dave McDonald didn't come up through the ranks of midget car racing or sprint cars. Instead, the handsome California driver made his name in sports cars. Author Art Gardner's highly acclaimed book, Black Noon, details the 1964 Indianapolis 500, and he extensively researched McDonald's career.
Just a couple months earlier, back in October, November of 63, he had won a sports car race out of Riverside and lapped a field that included Jimmy Clark, A.J. Foyt, Dan Gurney, Jim Hall, just the best road racers of the day. He had beat them all, lapped them all. He was a first-class drag racer when he first started his career. Did all his mechanical work himself. So really an outstanding driver, no matter drag racing, sports car racing. He finished second at Riverside in a stock car. Finished 10th at Daytona in a stock car in his first and only race there, and was the top non-NASCAR driver in that race. So really all-around greatness for Dave.
Speedway historian emeritus Donald Davidson says McDonald's star was on the rise in 1964.
I think he was a potential superstar in the making, and he had the previous year, he was a road racer primarily, and the two big sports car races at the end of the year, they would run Laguna Seca and Riverside, and I think they were like 2 weeks apart, and he won them both. And apparently that's where Mickey Thompson thought, that's the guy, because while he was a road racer, and some people would think, well, you know, they weren't really serious. You know, you had to drive sprint cars to be a true racer. But Dave McDonald would be sideways half the way because he would dirt track.
But at the Brickyard, McDonald and his teammates had trouble handling car owner Mickey Thompson's new streamline car. In fact, Mastin Gregory, an ace on the Formula One circuit, crashed one of the cars early in the month and left the team. The rookie McDonald had concerns.
Apparently, he was very concerned about its handling. And was told, he expressed that to his father and different people in racing. And apparently, you know, Carroll Shelby and Dan Gurney and others said, look, if it's scaring you, don't drive it. And he thought, well, I can't not drive it. I want to drive in the Indianapolis 500. And what am I going to look like if I get this opportunity and I withdraw? You know, I may never get another car to drive.
After the team made some changes to the bodywork on the car, McDonald qualified for his first Indianapolis 500, placing his Sears All-State Special 14th on the grid. Starting three spots behind the rookie was veteran Eddie Sachs, who had won the pole in 1960 and 61. Sachs was known as the Clown Prince of racing, but was a man of many layers, according to Art Gardner.
Absolutely. I think it's easy to say the Clown Prince of racing and just dismiss it at that. But no, a very, very caring person. You know, sitting with Eddie Sachs Jr. when I was interviewing him about the book, the number of people came up and said how they had been touched by Eddie during the course of his career was amazing. He really got a feel for who Eddie Sr. was by just sitting there with his son and having people come up and say, hey, your dad touched my life. You know, he took a picture with me. Mario Andretti tells a story that I've included in the book, that he's in the pits in Trenton, just really a kid over from Italy, doesn't speak much English. He goes up to Eddie Sachs and says, hey, I really admire you. I know you raced in Europe. This is when your Indy cars were racing in Europe. And Eddie started talking to him, took pictures with him, and Mario said it had a huge impact on him and how he would handle things later in life.
The 33-car field was set, but for many, racing at the Brickyard would never be the same just minutes after the green flag dropped on May 30th, 1964.
The yellow caution flag is being waved. The yellow light is on. There's an accident on the main stretch up in front of us. Jim Shelton, can you see it? Out of the fourth turn, there's a car burning.
This is Heroes of the 500, 1964.
It's race day 1964, time for the 48th running of the 500 on the greatest race course in the world.
This is Heroes of the 500, 1964. I'm John Herrick. The 1964 Indianapolis 500 shaped up as a battle between the dinosaurs and the funny cars, but it was the rear-engine cars dominating the front row, with world champion Jim Clark on the pole in his tradition-smashing Green Lotus. And when the green flag dropped, it was Clark getting the jump on the field.
This sight has no equal in sport for drama and suspense. Thousands of standing, screaming fans. Here they come down the main stretch, the world's fastest flying start. There's the green flag, and the 1964 500-mile race is on. Into the number one turn, and here's Bill Frosch.
We're watching. We're waiting, and Jim Clark is way out in front. He is far out in front of the rest of the pack.
Back in the pack, Dave McDonald's original plan was to take it easy on the start. But taking it easy isn't typically part of a racer's DNA. Speedway historian emeritus Donald Davidson.
The thinking is that he was said, look, it's a 500-mile race. Take your time. And if that was the mindset going in, well, the green flag drops and he's a racer. That goes out the window. And I don't know how many people have told me he went right by me. Len Sutton was one. Rutherford is another. And that all had to happen in the first lap because the accident happened as they were coming around to complete lap two. Everybody thinks it's the first lap. Well, they went by one. But those two and maybe a couple of others said, well, he went right by me. And then he tried to go underneath Walt Hansken coming out of turn four. And this was Len Sutton, who had an absolute eyewitness view. He said, hey, it happened right in front of me. And he said he tried to go under Walt Hansken, and Hansken was committed. He didn't chop him off. He was committed to the line. And then McDonald had to get out of it, and then that maybe have thrown the thing out of control. And so that caused this terrible accident.
Marston, Ward, and now moving up on the outside, passing point was finally Jones. And Dan Gurney is also coming into contention. The yellow caution flag is being waved. The yellow light is on. There's an accident on the main stretch up in front of us. Jim Shelton, can you see it out of the fourth turn? There's a car burning. Jim, come in.
Zip, there has been a spectacular crash almost at the head of the main stretch. There's so much fire and so much smoke, I am unable to see any car at all. Now the smoke is clearing away. We'll try to get the glasses on it, and perhaps somebody from the tower can see, Sid. Somebody did not make that number four all the way around, and kerwoom, right into the fence. And the yellow caution light is out. These drivers are using extreme caution, and we must compliment each and every one. There seems to be a fire in the pit area right now. Sid, back to you. Can you see?
We can see several cars on fire from here, but we are not going to attempt to give the number until they're officially given to us. We do not wish to alarm anyone. The safety crews are out there with their extinguishers and doing a good job of putting out one fire. There's a tremendous amount of heavy black smoke going back into the stand area, which is, of course, merely smoke going over the people there, and I trust they're not too much inconvenience, but it must be heavy and discomforting to them.
On the second lap, McDonald's car spun coming off the fourth turn. The car slid across the track and hit the inside wall, igniting a fire. The car then slid back into the center of the track, involving seven more cars. One of them, the machine driven by Eddie Sachs, hit McDonald broadside, causing a second explosion and sending a huge mushroom cloud of smoke over the speedway. Donald Davidson was watching his first Indianapolis 500 live.
The thing starts, and I'm down in the first turn, and the pace lap, and the end of the first lap, and here comes all the cars, seconds or so, 45 seconds down the straightaway. Here they come again. And this time, because I'm facing south looking into turn one from the infield in turn one. And I thought, wait a minute, there was only 12, 13 cars came through. And then I look up into the grandstands and I see everybody standing up and pointing. And I look around me and everybody that was down, everybody that had a silver badge, they've taken off running, and I look up, and over the master control tower, I see this thick black smoke. And I thought, oh, no, somebody's crashed into the pits. That's good. They've hit one of those fuel tanks. And so I take off running, And I'm sort of trailing everybody else. So I walk and run, and I realize I can get up onto the track. So I'm walking down the track, and I remember hearing out of the grandstands this, not quite a roar, but a loud buzz, because the thing stopped. So it was everybody talking. It's you know, 100,000 people that are talking, and the sound's reverberating off the aluminum and everything like that. And so I'm walking down the straightaway, and it's a long way, and I can see off in the distance that, you know, there's commotion down there. And as I'm walking, I'm thinking, well, obviously something terrible happened. Nobody crashed into the pits, but there's something major happened down there. And I'm thinking this could have been a catastrophe.
One man who was very much in the middle of the accident was future three-time Indianapolis 500 winner Johnny Rutherford. Rutherford had qualified 15th for Racing Associates in just his second Indy 500.
It was incredible. We started the race, and Eddie Sachs was, I think he was beside me. The green flag dropped, and we went into turn one, and Eddie pulled ahead of me. He was in a rear engine car. He went just ahead of me, and I fell in behind him. I thought, well, Eddie knows how to go to the front. I'll just see if I can hang on. We went running in there, and Davey went by on the second lap, went by me nearly with two wheels in the grass. And that's the way he drove sports cars. You know, he was sideways and so on. He went by, and I thought, wow. There's the guy that's either going to get to the front or crash. And we went down the backstretch, and I was right on Eddie's bumper. We went through turn three and across the short chute. And as we got to the end of the short chute, I saw this red car and the dust cloud as the car went sideways. And he hit that concrete wall and angled out toward the racetrack. And this giant ball of fire is just like drawing an orange and black curtain across the racetrack. Eddie was, you know, we were both hard braking at the time, trying to slow down from our speed. And it was not hard, not easy to do and at going that fast in those cars. And Eddie had a fluorescent, it's when that new fluorescent red paint came out, and he had a ball on the top of his helmet painted red, and I could see that. I still can see this accident just like it happened. And I could see that on either side of the roll bar, like he was looking for a way to go. And I was right on his bumper, and he just veered left just very slightly just before he impacted Davey. And both of those cars were the only two in the race with gasoline. And when he impacted, the rear of his car reared up in the air, and he put a tire, right rear tire skid mark up the nose of my Watson about 3 feet long. And I saw a gap between Davey's car, tailpipes and everything. And Eddie must have moved him because I had a shot to, it went, I think, over there, just slightly over the back of Davey's car, and just scuffed the wall and broke out. But when Eddie hit those two cars burning gasoline, it was like jerking the door open on a blast furnace. It was hot. And, of course, raining gasoline everywhere and threw my head forward on the impact and I got second-degree burns on the back of my neck from raining gasoline. And when I came out on the other side, my car was burning with gasoline all over it.
Rutherford had made it through the accident, but he didn't know he was out of the race.
I got out and clear on the other side, and the car was slowed down and starting to buck. So I reached down, unlocked the transmission, shifted it back to low gear, and tried to get going, and I heard an engine screaming, and just as I glanced left, Bobby Unser had hit the other car in our line. He crashed and got burned, but knocked the steering out on the Novi he was driving. And here he came across the track, and he hit me in the left rear and slammed me into the wall. And that fractured my fuel tank. I didn't know that at the time, but it didn't catch fire or anything. I drove on down the track and around turn one. Bob Weiss came up beside me and pointed to the infield and told me to go. And then he went on to keep up with the field. And I didn't know what it was, so I went down the backstretch, pulled into three. I just drove to the grass, and there was a guy there with a fire extinguisher. And I put it in neutral and stopped and kept the engine running. And I said, is there anything burning on the back of this? And he looked at it and shook his head, no. I thanked him, put it in first, drove on across the short chute, and pulled around to where the thing had happened. And pulled up there, and Don Branson was standing there, and he motioned me to stop. And I stopped, got everything down, unhooked seat belts, got out and stepped over, and then I could see the fuel, methanol running around the car, and two guys with fire extinguishers came over and stood by. And I started walking up toward the accident scene, and Don grabbed me by the arm. He says, "You don't want to go up there." And I said, okay. I said, my neck feels like it's burning. And he looked. He said, yeah, you got some second-degree blisters on the back of your neck. So he put me in an ambulance, and I went to the hospital. And I came back from the hospital with bandages on the back of my neck.
For the first time in the history of the 500, the race had been stopped by an accident. Davidson says one thought immediately crossed his mind.
And I knew already that there had been a senator a few years before that tried to get a bill put through that would basically abolish automobile racing and all the problems after the Le Mans accident in 55 and the Vukovich accident and all of this that AAA got out of racing. And now I'm thinking this could happen again. And I'm thinking Time magazine and all of the newspapers, the headlines are going to be, you know, enough of this, put a stop to it. And I thought, isn't that ironic that I spent all these years, 7 years, which at my age was a good part of my life, and I've come here, I've had the dream, I met all the people, and now it could be over. And I thought about that all as I walked down to the accident scene.
With the race stopped and the fate of several drivers hanging in the balance, Davidson and thousands of fans were left to wonder, what next?
So since death has 1,000 or more doors, Eddie Sachs exits this earth in a race car. Knowing Eddie, I assume that's the way he would have wanted it.
This is Heroes of the 500, 1964.
There's not much of an action report to give you at this time, or any other report to give you at this time. We can see many pieces of emergency equipment, fire, safety, ambulance, and wrecking crews down there.
The 1964 Indianapolis 500 had been stopped by a terrible accident involving 7 cars. The Speedway Radio Network had been around for a decade and had the sad duty of dealing with serious and tragically fatal accidents in the past. But never had the world's largest single-day radio network been put into a position where the race had been completely stopped due to an accident.
Back in the Master Control Tower, Indianapolis, Indiana, once again, and still, we have no official word, and I trust that you will bear with us and understand that our reason for not trying to give rumors is not to upset the wrong people. Those who are involved naturally will have to be upset if something serious has happened. I recall many years ago when a car bounced the wall here, and number 14 had the 1 scraped off as though someone had taken a phantom paintbrush and left the number 4. The announcer saw the 4, ran down his numerical list, and called the driver in car number 4, and it was 14. And that family was very perturbed out in California. So we'd rather this would not happen. We'd rather we'd wait, as I trust you would prefer us to do. There's a pall over this entire area, which is quite amazing, with over 300,000 people here today. Seeing everyone standing, no one is seated. They're all looking and straining, those in the main stretch. And those around the back, perhaps many, I'm sure, have transistor radios. They're picking up the report from us and also off the world's largest public address system.
The sense of dread hanging over the speedway came from fans waiting for an announcement they hoped would not come, but sadly, a few minutes later, came the first piece of dreadful news. Speedway public address announcer Tom Carnegie's announcement was carried live on the Speedway radio network, followed by perhaps the most well-known moment from the amazing career of Sid Collins.
Jack, Lou, or Luke, have any further information, or we can continue to hold the microphone up here and arrange for the start. And now here's an announcement of the public address system. Can we pick this up?
It is with deepest regret that we make this announcement. Driver Eddie Sachs was fatally injured in the accident on the main straightaway.
Speedway historian emeritus Donald Davidson.
And then so now you hear just the ambient noise and the blimps in the air and maybe a couple of choppers. And we're on live and somebody has to say something. So Sid begins to speak.
You heard the announcement from the public address system. There's not a sound. Men are taking off their hats. People are weeping. Over 300,000 fans here are not moving, disbelieving. Some men try to conquer life in a number of ways. In these days of our outer space attempts, some men try to conquer the universe. Race drivers are courageous men who try to conquer life and death, and they calculate their risks. And in our talking with them over the years, I think we know their inner thoughts in regard to racing. They take it as a part of living. No one is moving on the racetrack. They're standing silently. A race driver who leaves this earth mentally when he straps himself into the cockpit to try for what to him is the biggest conquest he can make, is aware of the odds, and Eddie Sachs played the odds. He was serious and frivolous. He was fun. He was a wonderful gentleman. He took much needling and gave much needling. And just as the astronauts do, perhaps, these boys on the racetrack ask no quarter and they give none. If they succeed, they're a hero, and if they fail, they tried. And it was Eddie's desire, I'm sure, and will, to try with everything he had, which he always did. So the only healthy way, perhaps, we can approach the tragedy of the loss of a friend like Eddie Sachs is to know that he would have wanted us to face it as he did, as it has happened, not as we wish it would have happened. It is God's will, I'm sure, and we must accept that. We're all speeding toward death at the rate of 60 minutes every hour. The only difference is that we don't know how to speed faster, and Eddie Sachs did. And so since death has 1,000 or more doors, Eddie Sachs exits this earth in a race car. Knowing Eddie, I assume that's the way he would have wanted it.
Collins' impromptu eulogy touched the hearts of fans in the stands and around the world. Author Bob Gates.
That was a huge broadcasting moment. I mean, there's people that listen to that that eulogy that aren't necessarily involved in auto racing as broadcasters or even sports. It's just one of those dynamic moments in the history of broadcasting that a lot of people study, a lot of people listen to. And I think what touched everyone was that he humanized it. He just wasn't given statistics about a driver that was well known, but he really talked to the human side. He touched on the human side of these guys and his relationship to them, his feelings about them. And I think that's what made it such a special moment. Again, Sid was on the radio doing that, but again, there's no engine noise, so you could hear Sid Collins' eulogy you know, when he gave it live. So it was a masterful piece.
Donald Davidson says Collins' incredible preparation allowed him to be ready for that difficult moment.
Some people have suggested that he had an obituary written for every driver and would bring out the one that was appropriate. Well, that's a bunch of nonsense. But had he given it some thought? Absolutely. Preparedness. And I think that, anyway, Sid was all about preparation. And he had to have thought when he was, you know, on a driving somewhere, if it happened, what would I say? And he was also great. He read a lot and he was great with quotes. And so when he did like the final thought and everything like that, he would give a lot of thought to what the final thoughts would be. And so I think that whether or not he had some notes or whether he did it off the top of his head, I don't know, because I wasn't up there yet. I went up later. But he may have just had a few notes written down. But he must have gone over in his mind, because he was a professional. You have to be prepared. What if it happened, what would I say? And so it was so very eloquent. And he would pause, and throughout it, all you can hear in the background is the blimp and the choppers and so on and so forth. And to be sitting in the grandstands must have been very, very moving.
But Davidson said Collins wasn't unaffected by the loss of the popular sax.
I actually went up during the red flag to the booth. And so Sid waved me in, and I think he said, "What do you know?" And he said, "Well, you know, we're all pretty somber up here right now." And I think he'd been crying. And because sax, he really liked, because sax was so funny. So, you know, they would do appearances together and banter off each other. And he would have known him for, golly, you know, 10 years or close to that.
For Davidson, the loss was also personal.
Well, I'd met Sax and had a great conversation with him, and I was amazed at how interested he was in European racing. In fact, he actually said to me, now this is the guy that had been on the pole and twice in recent years and finished second and third and had good runs. And he said to me, he said, "I've always admired the Europeans, because," he said, "we just go round and round in circles." This is one of the lead guys saying that. And he said, "When I was first following it," he said, "my hero was Tazio Nuvolari, and I about fell on the floor." So he said, has there ever been books? "I'd like to know more about Nuvolari." And I said, "As soon as I get home, I'll get some stuff together and send it to you." So he said, "Well, here's my card, and, you know, here's how you can reach me." And I've got it written down what date that was. But, you know, within a matter of days, I'm at this accident scene and he's deceased. But in answer to your question, I accepted that. I mean, did I cry? No. And I thought how sad it was. But I think you just accept that. And I really don't know how to put this. But for the next few years, and I went to work for USAC, and guys that I knew, the second year I was there, USAC had 7 fatalities, including 2 doubles. And I knew them all. And then, you know, you're at Conkle's funeral home, and then you go on.
While the focus was on the loss of Eddie Sax, doctors were trying to save the life of Dave McDonald, the worst of the injured drivers, which also included Bobby Unser and Ronnie Duman. A stunned crowd waited for the race to resume with a pall and smoke hanging in the air. This is Heroes of the 500, 1964. Welcome to Hour 2 of the Heroes of the 500, 1964. I'm Chon Herrick. The Indianapolis 500 had been stopped due to an accident for the first time in the event's history. The delay would last 1 hour and 42 minutes while the wreck was cleared away. Drivers and crew members were dealing with the tragedy as well. Future three-time Indianapolis 500 winner Johnny Rutherford was burned in the accident, and he and his crew got a tragic reminder of how violent the accident was when he returned to the garage area.
And I came back from the hospital with bandages on the back of my neck and went into the garage just the same time they took all the cars out of the race and sucked all the fuel out of them, if any, and they brought it back and pushed it in the garage, and Herb Porter, my crew chief, went over and unhooked the right side of my car hood and raised it up, and we both standing there looked in, and there was looked like sand and some gravel and a piece of windshield material, triangular shape, little piece, and there was a lump covered up with sand and everything, and Herb reached in and picked it up and brushed it off, and it had a shoestring run through it and around, and the end of it, it was a lemon, and it had the end cut off, and Herb says, "Where in the world do you reckon that came from?" And somebody at the door said, "Oh, my God." Herb said, "What?" It had a head that around his neck. And he used it to suck on during the cautions or during the race, you know. And anyway, that's how close it was.
As we detailed in the first hour, Tom Carnegie announced the death of driver Eddie Sachs over the public address system during the red flag. And the voice of the 500, Sid Collins, gave Sachs an incredible on-air impromptu eulogy. That eulogy was still resonating with fans while they waited for the race to resume. One of them was Michael R. Getzinger, who would grow up to become a well-known author and historian of the sport. Michael R. Getzinger passed away in 2015, but shortly before his passing, he shared his memories of that day with us.
That race, to me, was part of growing up. My father had a great love for the Speedway, and we would sit together and listen on the radio. That was what we did on Memorial Day. And here I was overseas in the Army, and being able to listen to that race was a connection to home. And then the accident was so stunning, and so it made me feel at the time that I was very, very, I was stationed in Okinawa at the time, and it made me feel I was very, very far from home. And of course, the tragedy reached everyone. So possibly in a different way than you mean, but it did have a huge impact on me.
Collins and his crew were in uncharted territory in 1964. They had sadly dealt with fatal accidents before, but never one that had stopped the race, nor one that had been so violent and dramatic in front of so many spectators. Collins knew the race would resume, and ever the consummate professional, he prepared those in attendance and around the world for that fact shortly after his eulogy for Sachs.
Freddie, do you have any further comment?
Well, but the only comment I have, please remember one thing, Sid. Nobody holds a gun to these men's heads. This they do because they love it and they enjoy it. And this is one business you can't get into and accomplish properly the talents that are required to drive a race car unless you love it and enjoy it. On the other hand, it's been Eddie's desire to go if he had to go in a race car. And it's just too bad that he had to come to an untimely end of this type.
Byron said, "Whom the gods love die young." Eddie was 37. His widow, Nancy, we extend our extreme sympathy and regret, and his two children. This boy won the pole here in 1961 and 1962 and was a proud race driver. Well, as we do at Indianapolis and in racing, as the world champion, Jimmy Clark, I'm sure, would agree, as he's raced all over the world, the race continues, unfortunately today without Eddie Sachs. And we'll be restarting it in just a few moments.
Now the third lap of the 500-mile race is underway as Hart, Marshman, and Ward roar by. The first turn, pick it up and follow them around. Bill Frosch.
Clark and Marshman are running 1-2 well ahead of the pack. And let's see, Mike, howdy. Here they come. It's Clark and Marshman. Marshman about one and a half car length behind Jim Clark as they stream through here. There's Roger Ward. Dan Gurney 3 blocks behind him. And there's A.J. Boyd, Cardell A. Jones.
Once the race resumed, there was another brief scare, according to Gates.
I remember when the race restarted, it was just a lot of apprehension on everyone's part. If this happened once, it could happen again. And would it happen again? On the first lap under green, they came around and there was so much oil dry and off the fourth turn there that it put up another huge cloud of smoke. And many people thought there had been another accident at that point. So people were really discouraged, I guess is a good way to. Some of the gaiety was gone. It was a beautiful day, not a cloud in the sky, but it just, you know, something was missing until Bobby Marshman passed Jim Clark. And then the place went wild again.
Bill Frosch on turn number one.
Coming through now. We're waiting. I believe Bobby Marshman is out in front. He was the last time around, Sid. We'll have to take a check on that. Everything is moving smoothly here on the number one corner. Back to you, Sid.
Bobby Marshman is in the lead. Let's swing around to number two and Howdy Bell.
We're looking for Bob Marshman to come through turn number two here in the lead, and here he is right now flashing by. He has probably a 30-car length lead over Jim Clark.
Bobby Marshman started on the front row with Clark, and 1964 was his best chance to win the 500. Marshman was a good-looking young driver who came from a racing family and was co-rookie of the year with Parnelli Jones in 1961. But Marshman, like many drivers on the USAC circuit, was sick of finishing second to A.J. Foyt. As Marshman's Pure Oil Firebird Special continued to pour on a huge lead in the early going of the 1964 Indianapolis 500, the young driver saw a driver up the road that he wanted to put a lap down, A.J. Foyt. Speedway historian emeritus Donald Davidson says Marshman's pit crew tried to get their young driver to think about the big picture.
After the restart, when he passed Clark, I mean, that was something, but I just figured, well, you know, maybe there's going to be a battle here. There was no battle. He started pulling away by 2.5-3 seconds per lap. And in the film, there's this shot where Beckley actually is out trackside with the pit board that says, cool it, chalked on a blackboard, and he's waving his finger at Marshman to slow down. When I mentioned that to Jack one time, he said, yeah, he said he'd finished second to Foyt so many times, and he thought this is the chance. Not only can he beat him, but he said he was obsessed with lapping him. And I'm saying, Bobby, when I say I'm saying, I'm quoting Beckley, just, you know, cool it. You can win, but he just wanted to beat Foyt.
The late author Michael Argetzinger's final book was an acclaimed biography of Bobby Marshman. He told us that Foyt was able to get in Marshman's head on that May afternoon in 1964.
He was dominating the race at that point. He was so far ahead of the field, he was a full 30 seconds ahead of Jim Clark, who was in second place. He had taken the lead from Jim on lap 7 after the restart. He drove away. And suddenly he sees A.J., his great rival, and from all the races over the years, and sees him up the road ahead of him. And what's interesting about it is it was so out of character, because Bobby Marshman had the rightful reputation as being cool and smooth and the very thoughtful, the thinking man's driver. So this was out of character, but he did have this feeling in his mind, and self-admittedly, that I have to lap AJ.
Well, if you watch that man, it looks like Bobby Marshman's number down there, 51,
right,
on the card.
Right, that's the card.
He's holding 51. The yellow flag is still out. The black flag was coming out for Bobby Marshman, number 51. Howard Bell, make it brief on the number two turn.
Well, Bob Marshman is fueling what is apparently fuel as he comes through these corners. The last three laps he's done it. That's probably the reason.
Well, thank you very much. We'll check now as Bobby Marshman comes down here. The yellow flag is still out, and the leader, number 51, Bob Marshman, the Pure Oil Firebird Special, has been black flagged to come in the pits for consultation.
Just a moment ago, Bobby Marshman slowed down considerably and pulled inside along the infield, and he should be on the main straightaway by now, Sid, but it does look like he is in trouble.
He's smoking, coming down in front of us.
Marshman ignored the cool it orders and continued to pour it on. On the 37th lap, Marshman took the Pure Oil Firebird Special low on the track to not hit eventual Rookie of the Year, Johnny White. The off-course excursion ripped out the oil and water lines, and Marshman was out of the race. Instead of driving to victory lane, Marshman was instead seen wandering through the crowd, even stopping at one point to buy a program in an attempt to somehow blend into the people. In our interview with him, Michael Argetzinger told us that 1964 was Bobby Marshman's shot at racing immortality.
He was out of character in that situation, and in so doing, really cost himself a really big chance, because had the car lasted, and there was every reason to think it would have, they had done 3,000 miles of testing with Bobby in the seat over the winter with the new engine from Ford, and that car was pretty reasonably bulletproof, as much as race cars were in those days. So there's every reason to think that Bobby would have won that race.
Later that year, the talented Marshman was badly burned in a crash during a tire test. He died 6 days later. With Marshman out, Jim Clark took over the lead, but the drama of the 1964 Indianapolis 500 was far from over.
Left rear wheel on Clark's car.
Jimmy Clark.
He's doing it well.
Here's Bill Froschen, turn number one. Pick it up, Bill.
Jimmy Clark is coasting to the inside of the track. That left rear wheel is off.
This is Heroes of the 500, 1964. This is Heroes of the 500, 1964. I'm John Herrick.
That besides the spray, they did see smoke, and gasoline on a hot engine will emanate smoke, and it's apparently a fuel tank and or fuel system leak somewhere, Sid, unfortunately.
And that puts Jim Clark back into the lead once again in car number six.
With Bobby Marshman out of the race, the lead was handed back over to the pole sitter, world champion Jim Clark. Clark and Team Lotus had originally been seen as outsiders, almost invaders of the brickyard. But the quiet Clark was quickly winning over fans, much to the surprise of Donald Davidson.
I think probably one of many surprises that I had was that in addition to the drivers being so friendly, I had it in my mind that I thought, boy, I'll bet those people don't like Clark. They thought, hey, you know, we're Americans over here. And, you know, Parnelli and Foyt and you know, those are our guys. And who's this guy from England that drives sporty cars? He's a teacupper. And I was astonished at how popular Clark was in 64. And he'd only run once. He was second the year before, and then he'd gone to Milwaukee and Trenton. And I was astonished at how popular he was. And people said, oh, you know, he's the, you know, the greatest. And then it wasn't too long before, you know, you were aware that people were calling their sons after him. I mean, there's a lot of James Clark's somebody or others running around out there today.
After 40 laps or 100 miles or one-fifth of this race, another new record, 149.335 miles per hour, set by Jim Clark in car number six.
But while Clark was leading the pack early, problems were developing. Team manager Colin Chapman had made a crucial miscalculation. Chapman had decided to use Dunlop tires in qualifying. The soft compound Dunlops worked well for the short 10-mile qualifying runs, but the rules required that the same type of tires had to be used in the race, and now they were wearing at an alarming rate. After completing just 47 laps, the suspension on Clark's Lotus gave way while the Scottish star was leading.
And there's trouble.
Left rear wheel on Clark's car.
Jimmy Clark.
He's doing it well.
Here's Bill Froschen, turn number one. Pick it up, Bill.
Jimmy Clark is coasting to the inside of the track. That left rear wheel is off. He's coming, rolling on down, trying to get the brakes on. He's down in front of us. He's getting the record cars out of the way, but he's all right. He's holding on and stops right here directly in front of us. In fact, he steers for the driveway down in front of us. But that left rear wheel has collapsed completely. They have the fire extinguishers on it, and before he even stopped, Jimmy Clark was up and out of that car. He rode it all the way down. The left rear wheel finally collapsing. He rode it on the grass all the way down as the photographers rush down here. We'll put our glasses on Jimmy to see if we can lip read a little bit, and I imagine he's most unhappy. He's looking under that tire now to see what might possibly have happened. to the engine. Bill Frosch, returning you now to Sid Collins. Sid?
Bill, thank you. Jim Clark, the world's champion driver, running steadily and smoothly, having such a thing happen to him with no control of his own over it. The yellow flag is now out.
He comes down the straightaway with the left rear wheel tucked over, and the crowd standing up. And I know that there was this air of tension because of what we just seen.
Clark's misfortune put defending champion Parnelli Jones into the lead and in the mix for the victory, but it wasn't long before another fire took out the 1963 winner.
We'll watch him from up here. We'll check him from up here. We're in, refueling, and back out again. No tire change, and there goes Parnelli Jones back out again, something like 15 seconds or less. And he roars back out. And there's something wrong with his car. His car is on fire. The Agajanian Bose Seal Fast Special shooting a few flames and some smoke down here. And now, Lou, is it close enough for you to see this time? The safety truck is coming down. They're throwing the carbon dioxide all over him. Parnelli leaped out of that car.
Parnelli is out of the car. They're moving in the CO extinguishers now, rushing the ambulance up. They're pulling Parnelli away, but he's on his own feet now. He's brushing himself off. Apparently, there's still a little bit of flame on Parnelli's suit, but they've got it out. He's standing up and at ease while they're still working on that car. 98 at Agajanian Bowl Seal Fast is still burning. Parnelli is being brushed down by members of the ambulance crew. He's a considerable distance from the car, isn't in danger of flame as such, and now they're taking him over to the ambulance, but Parnelli appears to be okay. It is just that they are going to take him certainly into the hospital area, and I believe he might have suffered some light burn damage. That fire is still going, though. They're having a devil of a time controlling it.
And then the next thing you know, now it's a battle with them. Foyt and Parnelli Jones in the two roadsters. And they're back and forth for about 5 or 6 laps, and it's first one, then the other, and the crowd, there's this huge roar each time because it's first one, then the other. Parnelli makes a pit stop, and his fuel tank explodes, and he bails out, and as opposed to the Sachs McDonald, which was a gasoline fire, this is an alcohol fire, which was a whole different thing because you can't see the flames. And I'm thinking, you know, what's going to happen next?
Fortunately, Jones was not injured, but the defending champion's pit fire put him out just 55 laps into the 1964 Indianapolis 500, and A.J. Foyt's last serious challenger had already fallen by the wayside.
A.J. Foyt now has the lead on this, the 69th lap of the race.
This is Heroes of the 500, 1964. This is Heroes of the 500, 1964. I'm Chon Herrick. By lap 56 of the 1964 Indianapolis 500, only 4 drivers had led a lap of the race: Jim Clark, Bobby Marshman, Parnelli Jones, and A.J. Foyt. And on lap 56, Foyt was the only one of the 4 drivers still left in the race.
All right, Sid, this is quite an interesting race. As you said a few minutes ago, the unexpected has happened here several times today. We noticed between Ward and Foyt that they're about 10 seconds apart. And did you notice their numbers are 1 and 2, and that's the way they're running right now. And back to you, Sid.
Foyt pulled away in his Sheridan Thompson special, with 2-time winner Roger Ward and Lloyd Ruby giving chase. While Foyt led the race, doctors tended to those injured in the terrible Lap 2 crash. Eddie Sachs, the beloved clown prince of racing, had been killed instantly in the accident, but rookie Dave McDonald, although badly burned, was pulled alive from the carnage at the north end of the track. But McDonald's lungs were seared in the inferno from inhaling flames, and 2 hours later, he died after being taken to Methodist Hospital.
We have an announcement to be made by Mr. Gary Campbell, who's with Sears Allstate Public Relations Department, car which was entered by Mickey Thompson, sponsored by Sears Allstate, and one of their drivers was Dave McDonald, who was injured earlier today. Mr. Campbell?
Thank you very much, Sid. We regret very much to announce that Dave McDonald did pass away this afternoon at 1:20 p.m. at the Methodist Hospital here in Indianapolis. And on the behalf of Mickey, who was very upset, and our sponsor, Sears Roebuck, we also want to wish all of Dave's many friends and his family deepest sympathies, and of course the same to Eddie Sachs, many friends and his family.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell, for making the announcement for us. One in a day is one too many, and certainly two is most regrettable, and we're very, very sorry to extend our sympathy here on our broadcast crew to those friends and families of Dave McDonald and Eddie Sachs.
Despite the tragedy of the loss of two competitors, the BorgWarner Trophy still waited for the winner. With his chief rival sidelined, there was nobody to challenge A.J. Foyt. Author Bob Gates.
Then when Marshman fell out, Clark fell out, Parnelli fell out, I think it's really the deflation part really came, it became almost humdrum of a race at that point. And like I said, Foyt went on to lead 146 laps, so he pretty much dominated the race at that point.
Back in the Master Control Tower at Indianapolis, Indiana once again, and Fred, we would have been off the air just about now in normal conditions. Fred and I usually sit here and munch on some chicken, but we'll have to hold that off for another hour, so I'm certain when we see who wins this 500. Car number one, A.J. Foyt, has a 47-second lead over car number two, Roger Ward. Ward has a 26-second lead over car number 56, Jim Herdebees, in third place at the end of 129 laps, and there are 16 cars running.
In the final box score, you'll see that of the top 22 finishers on that May Day in 1964, only one even led the race.
Let's pick up Mike Ahern in the number three turn.
Okay, Sid, A.J. Foyt just went by us in the number three turn. He's on the short chute heading toward number four now in Jim Shelton. Sid?
All right, and thank you very much, A.J. Foyt. Number one car in number one position. Houston, Texas specialist is rolling to the big money. And here is Sid Collins to report it.
Pat Vidan, chief starter, has the white flag out and will follow A.J. around. And here he gets the white flag. One more lap to go. Here's our eventual winner if he finishes this tour of the track. Bill Frosch, pick him up in turn number one.
I pick him up, and here he comes, riding low toward me now, coming into the short south chute. Past me and on to Howdy Bell. And we see A.J. Foyt now coming down to the white line. In turn number two, he looks kind of happy as he goes through two, onto the backstretch, and in just a second, he'll be up to Chuck Marlowe on this final lap.
Roger, Howdy, and he has the backstretch all to himself. Here he comes, A.J. Foyt, number one, entering up toward that northeast turn, the big wave to all the fans. He's in the northeast, and Mikey Hurst.
We got him here. People waving their hats, their hands, waving to him, and he waves back as he takes the turn number three. One more turn to go to Jim Shelton.
And he's in this turn right now, Mike. White car, big goal number one, a happy A.J. There you have what looks like our winner, and I don't think he can miss now. He has about half a straightaway to go, and here's Sid Collins.
Well, nothing should happen now, and here comes the car, the Sheraton Thompson Special, the checkered flag for A.J. Foyt, with the right hand up in the air, waving to the crowd, the winner of the 1964 500-mile race.
A.J. Foyt led for 146 laps, the most he would ever lead in any of his four wins. He pulled into victory lane and smiled for photographers until he was handed the traditional instant newspaper headline, which read, Foyt winner in 500, Sachs McDonald die.
Everything was beautiful. The car worked good. Everything went to schedule like we planned it.
This morning, before you're off the line, did you have some question in your mind as to whether you might have done better in a rear engine machine? We had so much talk about it, the end of an era and all of that.
Well, actually, Pernelli Jones and myself, everybody was kind of laughing at us all the time for running these old antique cars, but these antique cars have made me an awful lot of money, and I'm still proud of them, and I ain't for sure if I have a rear engine car next year or not.
You're going to be back next year.
Yeah, I think so.
Going for that three time. Well, congratulations again.
A.J. Foyt reminisced about his second victory with us in 2012.
Well, that's true, and a tragic accident like that takes a lot out of you afterwards, because sure, you're happy with the win, but I knew all them boys that lost their lives, and you know, like Eddie Sachs that day, where we had such great races, and fortunate enough, I was able to drive his sprint car, the Cheeseman car that he won so many sprint car races in, and you just hate to see anything like that happen, and I'm just kind of glad the cars are so much safer today than they were then.
The Sachs and McDonald tragedy became national news. Photographs of the fiery crash were featured on the front page of newspapers across the country and in color magazine spreads, and film footage was seen worldwide. Immediately, the accident almost took on a life of its own, spawning myths that perpetuated for decades. Author Art Garner ran into some of those myths firsthand while researching his acclaimed book on the 1964 500 Black Noon.
The big myth is that Dave McDonald's car was holding 100 gallons of gasoline in it. And as one of the mechanics I talked to told me, you know, where are you going to put 100 gallons in that car? There's no room for 100 gallons of gasoline. But time and again, when I would interview drivers, I asked them, what did you think about the Thompson car? The answer was, well, isn't that the car that carried 100 gallons of gasoline or 80 gallons or 75 gallons? And it's just amazing that the myth continued all these years. When it was established shortly after the race, the USAC hearings, that the car had 45 gallons in it. You know, the mobile person said, hey, we put 45 gallons in that car. That's it. There's always been a picture of Dave McDonald driving very aggressively and maybe even a little bit out of control. But from everything I've seen, he was certainly driving aggressively, but never out of control. He lost control, in part because the car was very difficult to handle. But he wasn't driving out of control.
Garner says 1964's lasting legacy may have come in the aftermath of tragedy.
I think that woke up the Speedway and USAC and led to many of the safety features, or at least a start in the direction of safety that's been carried through over the years and really perhaps saved the sport in many respects. There were no limits on gasoline at the time or any kind of fuel. You could carry as much as you wanted. You could carry 100 gallons if you wanted to or were able to. No weight limits. Some of those cars were under 1,000 pounds, which is amazing. It was a first step towards safety regulations that really changed the sport. Also, after the race, the president of Firestone challenged his engineers to come up with, you know, we need to put something on the walls to make them safer. So it took a long time, but I think that was the first step towards safer walls, too.
The United States Auto Club mandated that cars would carry less fuel in 1965 and effectively, but not totally, eliminated the use of gasoline as well. Most cars changed to methanol for 1965. In addition, Firestone introduced a new fuel cell in 1965 designed with safety in mind. Speedway historian emeritus Donald Davidson.
The impression and the myth is that gasoline was banned after the Sachs-McDonald accident in 64. And I mean, they ran out the year, but in 65, you couldn't use gasoline. Not true. The USAC board did a very smart thing in that they thought, we don't think that it's right to ban it and say you can't use it, but let's do something to discourage people from using it. And so what they did was they put in two mandatory pit stops. In 64 and earlier, there was no mandatory pit stop. So if you could go the distance without coming in at all, you could do that. And so anyway, they mandated 75-gallon tanks and that you would have to come in twice. And more than that, you would have to hook up the hose. You couldn't come in, get a drink of water, and leave. You had to hook up the hose. So the theory there was, if you're going to have to hook up the hose, then you may as well put something in. And the advantage, the reason you would use gasoline was that you would get better mileage. Methanol would burn up faster, you would run faster. So the thing was that when you had the decision, if you could get by on one stop on gasoline, you may have an advantage over somebody on methanol trying to stop twice. So anyway, then the thinking was, if you've got to stop twice anyway, you may as well use methanol. So most people did, but as Parnelli Jones and Agajanian, interestingly enough, they decided to do a blend, and they mixed gasoline with methanol. They stopped twice. They were down on power, and they said, "We won't do that again. If we just run straight methanol, we could have run faster." So, for a few years thereafter, you could still use gasoline, but you were just discouraged from doing so through the rules.
We'll wrap up our look back at the 1964 Indianapolis 500 right after this. This is Heroes of the 500, 1964. This is Heroes of the 500, 1964. I'm John Herrick. While the 1964 Indianapolis 500 is rightfully remembered for the tragedy that took the lives of two incredible race car drivers, Eddie Sachs and Dave McDonald, there was also some joy to be found on that Saturday afternoon. Sid Collins has long been praised for his incredible eulogy of Eddie Sachs, But during the 1964 broadcast, he also gave the world one more lasting legacy. On May 30th, 1964, Collins introduced the world to a man who went on to enrich the enjoyment of racing fans, perhaps as much as any driver.
Thanks, Fred. Alongside me is Donald Davidson. Donald dropped us a line last year after the 500 broadcast. He lives in London, England. He's a projectionist in a cinema there, he said, and was a race statistician and would like to join our broadcast crew. Well, we answered his letter, and he asked for a picture, and we sent that along. Donald, I don't know why in the world you wanted that, but we sent one to you. Then he wrote me back, and we corresponded, and he finally decided he would come over here and take his 7 years life savings, he's age 21 now, and be here and watch the Indianapolis activity for the first time. And when he got here, everyone, and I mean from Tony Holman on down and around, has been astounded by this young man's great wealth of knowledge on the Indianapolis 500-mile race. Don, I can't ask you the question such as how are you enjoying it, because naturally with the death of two of the participants, it could not have been pleasurable for you. But being here at Indianapolis, I know, has been, just being in town.
Well, it's been marvelous the way I've been received. I didn't expect this at all. When I arrived here, I was quite prepared to speak to maybe two mechanics and a driver, and I would have been happy. But everyone has been just marvelous. I've really had a wonderful time.
And we invite you to be on this broadcast because we are heard through Armed Forces Radio Service in London. That's where you have been listening to us over these years.
That's right.
Well, now I want to give the people just a little idea of what you do. They'll have to take my word, and I'm sure our listeners trust me after all these years. Donald has no notes in front of him. We can name any race driver, and he has the knowledge of Indianapolis drivers from 1911 on, and here's the way he does it. Let's say a name, Fred Frame.
Fred Frame first came here in 1927. He drove a Miller Special. He was relieved by after only five laps. George Furnick took over, and he alternated with George Abel. The car finished in 11th place. Frame only drove the five laps, but he got back into the race as a relief driver on Frank Elliott's Junior 8 Front Drive Special, which was owned by Cliff Durant. It finished 10th. In 1928, he drove an SAI Special. He finished in 8th place with Ben Shove co-driving. 1929, he drove a Cooper Special. He finished in 10th with Johnny Seymour co-driving.
I don't have to be rude again, interrupt you, because the fans are going to say, get Davidson back to London, let's see what's going on. But I want to show him what you do. It's fantastic, and take my word, I kid you not, Jack Parr says, this young man does this without any notes. He has studied in Indianapolis, and this is his first race in his life. I'm glad you came in to see us. Thanks, Don.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we'll see you at the Victory Dinner tomorrow night.
Okay.
All right? Very
sure
good.
Is.
Donald Davidson from London, England, and he's a fabulous guy. Isn't he, Fred? You've talked to him out there in the garage.
Oh, he certainly is. And when you said he hasn't any notes, the only notes he has is inside of his head. And that boy is fantastic. He ran me off from the day I came here. And he's done it several times now, and without a hitch in it. It's fantastic. And we threw out a few old ones at him, too, you know, old boys that I don't remember. And he did an excellent job in reviewing their entire history.
Well, he has loved Indianapolis all of his life, and the reason it's so unique is he lives in London. He'd never seen an auto race before this one today.
Davidson says he was thrilled that his dream came true his first year at the Speedway in 1964.
He was extremely good to me, and very quickly on, in fact, on Sunday afternoon, I was interviewed over the PA with Jim Phillippe, and people still talk to me about that. And so I started having conversations with Sid about maybe being on the broadcast. And in those days, especially during race week, in like a couple of weeks leading up to the race, and certainly race week, there were all kinds of functions. And Sid was the MC at everything, it seemed like. And he would always introduce me. And that was strictly on him. He just would introduce me as a visitor from England. And sometimes I would go and participate in the program. And so we had some discussion about me actually being on the broadcast in 64, doing what I had originally fantasized.
Davidson says he's never thought that his first appearance in 1964 would turn into more than a 50-year career as the storyteller of the Speedway.
Oh, no, no. And more than that was, and I don't know how to say this without it sound like, you know, that I'm tooting my horn, but after it, I mean, people said, oh, we heard you. But as the years have gone by, you know, it there's not very long between somebody saying, I heard your first broadcast. And I mean, that's still happening to today.
The classy Davidson always appreciated the door that Collins opened for him.
I came back the next year, and then I was part of the Bray State broadcast, and I had emigrated. I got a job with the United States Auto Club, and then the following year, I did a very short program, which was the forerunner of what became the talk of Gasoline Alley. So I owe Sid Collins a huge deal of gratitude. And in fact, Henry Banks, who hired me at USAC, and Sid, I think of the people outside of my family, those are the two people to whom I owe the most. And so and I didn't think to do this until fairly recent years, but now at least once on race day, I try to slip in, "Thank you, Sid."
At the end of each race, the voice of the 500, Sid Collins, would leave listeners with a closing thought, and we leave you now with Sid's words from May 30th, 1964.
And now for another year, the track is cleared. Pat Vidan has waved the red flag. Stands and bleachers are emptying. The curtain rings down on another of the great dramas of the world of sport, the famous 500. Gone for now is the roar of the Offenhauser, the tremble of the Novi's deep throat, and the screaming whine of the rear-engine V8 Fords. And back in Gasoline Alley, where we're heading shortly, is A.J. Foyt being besieged by friends and fans and well-wishers who want a glimpse and a touch of the champion of speed. There are many others who in their garages sit in deep disappointment. For them, the long wait of another year, but there's always the cry, "We'll be back to give it another go." And with us, we trust in the start of the engine through the wave of the checkered flag. I'd enjoy hearing from you. You may write to me, Sid Collins, care of Indianapolis Speedway, Indianapolis, Indiana. This broadcast originated by WIBC, Indianapolis. This thought as a salute to our winner. There's no thrill in easy sailing when the skies are clear and blue. There's no joy in merely doing things which anyone might do. But there is great satisfaction that is mighty sweet to take when you reach a destination that you thought you couldn't make. A.J. Foyt thought he could, and he did it today. His dream came true, and ours to enjoy and to share with him. Again, our sorrow and the loss of Eddie Sachs and Dave McDonald. So for May 30, 1964, this is Sid Collins wishing you a pleasant good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where you are right now. We're here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway at the crossroads of America. Goodbye. Network.
This has been Heroes of the 500, 1964. I'm John Herrick.